America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and in the midst of all the celebration about what is basically a good thing, which is the agreement on the infrastructure bill. A lot of people are saying this shows, well, it is possible. Yes, maybe. Not just a fantasy. Republicans and Democrats can, on occasion, work together. Can Republicans and Democrats work together to get the rest of America vaccinated? There's actually an encouraging example, and this is something we're celebrating on a Friday, is most adults, the overwhelming majority, have been completely vaccinated. Over 90% vaccination coverage, tops in the world. Where? Well, you'll be surprised. It's a poor country. Can we do that well here in one of the richest countries in the whole world? We will be talking about that. We'll also be talking about the war on cops. And there is a very prominent liberal, in fact, a Democratic socialist, who was saying, you know what, that war on cops, big mistake. And Democrats are going to get creamed. They're going to get filleted and mashed and sliced up and lose everything if they don't change the narrative on crime and the police. We'll be speaking with Katrina VandenHeuvel, who is someone really far on the left. I mean, way to the left of Biden and Harris. And she says they're blowing it on police. And I think most Americans, certainly most conservatives, will agree with that. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. We also have reviews about Jungle Cruise. This is a big, expensive, lavish movie starring Emily Blunt, the Mary Poppins replacement, and The Rock, Dwayne Johnson. We will be covering that. Is it worth your time and money? It's available on Disney Plus, but you gotta pony up some cash to have it available to your whole family. We will cover that and cover a new movie about the medieval era, which is getting rave reviews, called The Green Knight. And there's a movie about the Olympics, and it's about the dark side of the Olympics. It's about Olympic athletes who seem to have everything. I mean, great, good-looking, athletic, obviously, people, very successful at the Olympics, including gold medal winners, who suffer from clinical depression, suicide attempts, and even several suicides. What's going on? Why? We will talk about that because that also goes to some of America's ongoing problems. And speaking of ongoing problems, there's breaking news this morning. It's actually something that happened Wednesday night, so it's not that long ago, right here in Seattle. And again, it's the kind of thing where Seattle is making national news for all the wrong reasons, for all the horrible reasons. There was a sex offender just been released from jail, and a guy with a lifelong criminal record. Homeless guy, of course. And the homeless sex offender got in a little bit of trouble in a bathroom on the second floor of the courthouse, right here in downtown Seattle. And a female courthouse worker was attacked and assaulted. Actually, it was Thursday morning in a second floor bathroom at the King County Courthouse. Here's the way that Cairo 7 reported the story.
This is the attempted rape suspect as he was led out of the courthouse bathroom. Sources identify this man as 35-year-old Clint James Jory, a homeless registered sex offender who had just been released from a 21-month jail sentence last Friday after he was convicted of attacking and assaulting four women around downtown Seattle in 2019.
We get people off the streets all the time in the bathrooms, you know.
Frightened female courthouse workers who asked not to be identified told told Cairo 7 this alleged attack did not surprise them. Police sources tell Cairo 7 Clint Jory went through security this morning just like anyone else, but he was hiding in the women's bathroom. They say when a courthouse worker walked in, Jory attacked her with his shirt off and his pants down. A King County deputies who heard the victim's screams had to use force to restrain Clint Jory and put him into handcuffs. We're told the victim was released to family members after King County paramedics released her.
The story is unbelievable. It, again, this goes on, the news report from Cairo 7, and they did a good job. This is 14B.
Other courthouse workers told us this kind of crime was bound to happen because people who live in the notoriously dangerous encampment at City Hall Park next door come in the courthouse all the time.
It is. It's very uncomfortable. It makes you insecure because they're in there changing their clothes. They're talking, you know, people with mental health issues and stuff. And so, you know, it makes you very uncomfortable being in those closed areas just in general.
According to court documents, Jory's previous crimes were similar, saying, quote, the defendant attacked four women, all of whom were strangers to him, who were simply going about their day working in downtown Seattle. Courthouse workers tell us this attack must be the breaking point.
The city and stuff isn't going to do anything until somebody gets killed.
God forbid. They quote another, in news accounts, they quote another female courthouse worker who said this: homeless people do have the right to come into a building, a public building, and just sit around and or live in the bathroom sometimes, or take baths and stuff in there. What do you mean they have the right to take baths in the public bathrooms in the courthouse? The courthouse is supposed to be the symbol of law and order, right? I mean, this is where sentences are handed down. Like this idiot's sentence. Again, does somebody believe that building more low-cost housing is going to take care of somebody like this? I'm serious about that. Because he is far more representative of the people who live in City Hall Park right next to the courthouse and who have been engaged in every kind of violent crime. It's this entire story is so typical of where we are. They report that Jory has a long criminal history in North Dakota and in Washington State. Surprise, surprise, according to public records. He was convicted 2 years ago of attacking and sexually assaulting four women at random in downtown Seattle. Records show Jory was released from jail last week, and he registered as a sex offender the day before the attack. Okay. If you want to say that, well, there's just nothing we can do about homeless people, can we maybe have a little bit of focus on homeless sex offenders who have just been released from prison and then find their way into a bathroom in the courthouse? And by the way, this is not only a Seattle thing, though it's especially a Seattle thing. There's a new piece in The Hill, which, again, is a national publication, that says that Seattle is on edge. America's most liberal city is facing a crisis. And yes, it's part of that same crisis angst, it says, grips America's most liberal city, anxiety. And they say that in regard to the upcoming election. But Reagan Dunn, at least, on the King County Council, and it is the King County Courthouse, is calling for them to finally do something about clearing out the homeless encampment in City Hall Park. There's more, and this is going to be a very big issue, without question, in the recall election for Gavin Newsom in California. And maybe that'll start a domino effect in cities and communities across the country, and it'll be a good thing. A piece by a big liberal, who says it's hard to have faith in a state that can't even house its people. So what happened next? Well, there was, in a very pricey, fashionable tourist area of Los Angeles, there was a brawl that was captured on tape. We'll play you the great sound effects and more coming up on the Michael Medved Show. 1-800-955-1776. just Seattle, though it's especially Seattle. I mean, the stupidity that seems to suggest as a one unidentified courthouse employee does suggest that homeless people have the right to live in the bathrooms sometimes or take baths and stuff in there. That's what a female courthouse worker said. She says, it makes you feel uncomfortable in closed spaces in general because you know you're never safe. How can you not be safe in a courthouse, for God's sake? This is insanity. And people need to remember this when they vote. Reagan Dunn, who's been a guest on the show several times, who is the voice of sanity in the King County Council, says, I am requesting... He sent a letter to the mayor, Jenny Durkan, and to King County Executive Dal Constantine. Reagan Dunn said, I am requesting that the courthouse, the administration building, and the Chinook building be shut down to all except to employees and people with necessary business until the situation at City Hall Park can be adequately addressed and we can ensure the safety of our employees. This was an employee. It's a female. She was screaming. She had to be rescued from this guy who had no pants and was trying to rape her. I mean, this is some unbelievable stuff. And the idea that people say, well, yeah, we just have to do more to provide affordable housing. But just take a look at the profile of this individual, which is far... far more typical of the people who are living on the street than you will often see portrayed in media. And you walk around a homeless encampment, you can tell. For instance, there has been a homeless problem on Venice Beach Boardwalk forever. I moved to the Venice neighborhood in 1975. That's a long time ago, my gosh. And we lived there till 96. So it's a long time. Now, what you're about to hear took place on the Venice boardwalk, that runs right along the ocean. And for people who are not familiar with it, it's a long stretch where you can walk, you can bicycle, there are bicycle lanes on a beautiful day. It can be beautiful. You have the Pacific Ocean on one side, and on the other side, you have a lot of little shops and storefronts. What you're about to hear occurred right in front of the synagogue that I helped to found on the Venice Boardwalk, known today as the Shul on the Beach. It's officially Pacific Jewish Center. We started it, and there was always some kind of problem with homeless people wandering in the middle of services. And basically, I always sat by the door to try to prevent that from happening, because usually people were trying to mooch food. And we were open to everybody, but there's so many people who were living in that area always who were crazy and out of it and delusional and, frankly, dangerous. And there were little kids, including my little kids, who were running around at services and were very well attended. But, of course, a big factor in suppressing that attendance now, as the Shul on the Beach continues, under excellent leadership, by the way, great people, a lot of our old friends. And this was identified, this brawl that broke out on Wednesday. It identifies as right in front of the Fig Trees Cafe, which is next door to Pacific Jewish Center, the Shul on the Beach, our religious institution. And this is the way that lovely incident from this week was covered by CBS KCAL. Listen.
Cell phone video shows a disturbing brawl among what appear to be three homeless men on the Venice Beach boardwalk. In the video posted on Twitter, you can see a man armed with a long pole charge toward another man who was seen exchanging punches with a third guy. At one point, a security guard attempts to step in to break things up, but to no avail.
But it's not an uncommon sight.
The assistant manager at Fig Tree Restaurant says fights like this happen all too often. He says the homeless issue has definitely taken a major toll on local businesses.
With the restaurant being open till 9 or 10 o'clock, people are scared to come to the boardwalk at past a certain time.
In the video, you can see LAPD officers present nearby. However, it doesn't appear the men involved were detained, and our calls to the department regarding Wednesday's fight were not immediately returned. The incident comes as efforts are underway to clear out the countless tents that have taken over one of California's most popular tourist attractions. We walked a stretch of the boardwalk and noticed a big difference with fewer encampments on the sidewalk, a relief to both locals and business owners.
Just ecstatic that all of this is gone, all of the crud is gone.
We're noticing an increase in traffic for the evening crowds, which is great because it's a little bit safer.
A spokesperson for the Sheriff's Department says their teams have been out here along with LAPD and sanitation crews to clean up the area and make it safer for everyone.
And people we spoke with say they want to see long-term solutions to get the homeless into housing and off the streets permanently.
Okay. Here is the basic point. This is the slogan. This is the liberal answer. We just need to get the homeless into housing, and then everything will be fine. It's just fine. Let me tell you that the people who are involved in the brawl you just heard, and if you actually see the video, it's just pathetic. These are people who are deeply impacted by substance abuse. It seems fairly obvious. And if you say, okay, here's a place for you to stay, it doesn't do anything about their problems. And frankly, even getting them some medical attention where they recommend some antipsychotic drugs, something that's going to calm people down a little bit, maybe allow them to think about a job or something like that, there's no way under current laws that you can actually force people. And I'm not suggesting that we should or we must, but you need something other than just saying, oh, build housing and they'll be fine. Look, we've had a huge, it's almost an 80-year experiment with public housing. And what it shows is when you take people who are involved in a criminal underculture or are substance abusers who have desperate problems, and you give them a new free place in a public housing project, it very quickly turns that public housing project into something like an encampment, except more dangerous, because it's more enclosed and more a shelter for gang activity. The point is, as usual, and this is one of the key differences between the left and the right, the problem isn't a material problem. Problem isn't guns with crime. The problem is criminals, it's people. The problem with very dysfunctional people living on the street isn't a lack of housing, it's a lack of any structure to these lost lives, which needs to be imposed. We will be right back on the Michael Medved Show with more on the poverty issue coming up. Michael Medved Show. I like good news as much as anybody. In fact, I like good news more than most people, especially on a Friday. But sometimes good news leads you to all kinds of misleading conclusions. There was a headline in the New York Times yesterday. The headline, Pandemic Assistance Pushes Poverty to Lowest Level on Record. Wow. New York Times is saying that since 2018, when the government started sending great big gobs of money for COVID-19 relief and to save our economy, there have been 20 million Americans who have moved out of poverty. 20 million! 45% of all the people who have been poor are no longer poor. We have the lowest percentage of poor people, New York Times says, ever. Now, is that accurate or true? I immediately thought of, and then I saw he was actually quoted in this article. Robert Rector knows as much about poverty as anybody in the country. He's written about it. He was the intellectual godfather of the very successful welfare reform that was passed during the Clinton administration back in the 80s and changed lives in a positive way for literally millions of people. So, Robert, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the show. Is the New York Times celebrating a little bit too early this demise of poverty thanks to government money?
No, because basically, you know, what I would say is, setting aside all the money that we spent on the COVID crisis and all that, if you just went back to the basic welfare state that we have, I can say I can cut the poverty rate by two-thirds. Just like this, I'll snap my fingers, I can do it in 24 hours, doesn't cost an additional penny, you can get rid of all that extra spending. How do I do that? I simply count accurately the massive amount of money, which is about $1.2 trillion, for example, that we give to low-income families with children. I count that correctly, and all of a sudden, poverty is cut by two-thirds. You don't have to add any more money and so forth. So whenever they are talking about reducing poverty, you have to understand that it presupposes miscounting the poverty level in the first place. The reality is that setting aside all that extra money and setting aside the new money that Biden wants to spend on top of that, the average family with kids, for example, which the government identifies as being poor, and this is the group where we're shrinking their poverty rate, okay? Well, even before all that extra money is added in, that family has economic resources of $84,000 a year. How in the world is that possible? And let me just clarify that. So that's when you take their cash, food, housing, and medical care, that comes to around $62,000 a year. And then all of those families also get completely free public education. So that's $84,000 a year. About 80% of that is coming directly from the government in terms of assistance. But when the government goes to count poverty, they only count about $2,000 or $3,000 of that as income for purposes of measuring poverty. Entire programs, food stamps, the earned income tax credit, the Medicaid system, and not to mention the free public education, none of that is counted. And so basically you start out by having a grotesque miscount of poverty by hiding all of the assistance that we currently give, and also undercounting earnings by about 50%. And then you have a high poverty rate, and then they come in and they add in all this money, and they very scrupulously count all of that. Well, my goodness, look at how successful that policy is. And it's all predicated on the fact that all the discussions that you have about poverty in the welfare state begin by pretending that the current welfare state doesn't exist, and therefore there's poverty, and therefore we must spend more money, which we will count accurately in our studies, in order to alleviate a poverty situation that for the most part doesn't exist. Under our current system, for example, for families with kids, we sort of have an implicit goal in that system that if the parent or one parent is working a reasonable amount, we will give them enough additional assistance so that no one in that family will be poor. We already pretty much do that, and we spend huge, huge amounts of money. We start out with premises that basically in our society, every low-income child gets almost completely free public education. That's fine. I agree with that. They now get completely free. The whole family gets completely free medical care. No argument there.
And wait a minute. Let me ask you about this, because this has just been brought up recently. Kids get meals at school.
Absolutely.
And,
right.
And there's been a call now to provide three meals a day permanently,
right.
And not just when kids are in school, and not
right.
just as an emergency COVID thing. So
right.
we spend some money on that.
And we give them the earned income tax credit, which is about $7,000 a year for most of these families.
Which, by the way, you hear people hear tax credit. They think that just reduces the taxes that they pay.
No, this comes
to them like a check, right?
It's a cash grant. It's not a refund of any withholding or anything. It's just a cash grant. So we spend, as a whole, overall, as a nation, we spend $1.2 trillion on cash, food, housing, and medical care for the poor, almost none of which is counted when the government measures poverty. So the entire welfare state is off the books, and then they come out every year and say, my goodness, what we need here is to spend more money on welfare because look at all these poor people we have. And again, they're doing that because the whole welfare state is off the books. And then even on something like the individual's earnings, when you go and look and at the individuals and compare it to, say, their Social Security record on their earnings, the Social Security taxes they paid on their earnings, they're undercounting the earnings by 40-50%.
Okay, let me ask you this, because we were just talking about the homeless crisis in L.A. and in Seattle and across the country. With all this so-called good news that they're trying to put forward about poverty and bringing kids and families out of poverty, and it's just so wonderful, and the massive programs you're talking about, which haven't gotten smaller, they've probably gotten
much bigger,
vastly larger under COVID. Okay, with all that spending, how come the number of homeless people on the street has just exploded?
Yes. The reality is that whenever your audience sees a report about poverty on mainstream TV or something, you're going to hear that there are 40 or 50 million poor people, and then you might hear some miracle story about how if we can just spend another couple trillion dollars, that number will go down. But there are 40 or 50 million poor people, and then they're going to show you a picture of boarded up townhouses in South Baltimore or in Detroit or in Compton or something like that. And they're trying to tell you that there are 40 or 50 million people living like that. That's just absolutely not true. In fact, almost everyone that they identify as being poor, in fact, has economic resources that pull them well above poverty once you actually count them. But there is a group.
We need to continue on that in a few moments. Robert Rector is a senior research fellow in domestic policy at the Heritage Foundation, and he has published on the issue of poverty and poverty programs for many, many years, about 30, I think. And he has been dubbed the intellectual godfather of welfare reform by National Review editor Rich Lowry. Okay, when we come back, Dr. Rector, I would like to actually go on what needs to be done. Because obviously poverty still exists. We're a very wealthy country. Will the wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren so eagerly proposes, will that take care of it? What would, and what about the connection between poverty and homelessness? We'll get to all of that coming up with Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation. Medved Show, speaking with Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., about the New York Times hailing the virtual end of poverty in the United States because of all of the money that has been pumped into emergency relief during the COVID-19 crisis. And by the way, some of those bills and some of that money came during the Trump administration. And the New York Times article, Robert Rector, it focuses on a number of very sympathetic recipients of this government aid. And one of them is a woman named Catherine, who's 29. She's a single mother of five in St. Charles, Missouri. And it says that she had a job managing a trailer park that paid her $34,000 a year. Then she lost her job, and with her job, with the food stamps and other benefits and the refundable tax credit, and her income actually came up to $52,000, her real income, with right. five children. And then what they point out is that with the bonus checks that came in for $12,000 and $29,000 in additional jobless benefits, instead of her income of $33,000, she's now bringing in $67,000 mm-hmm. a year.
Right.
Which sounds pretty solid. She says, in my case, yes, it was very beneficial, she said. But she also said other people she knew bought big TVs with the extra money, and that her former boyfriend bought drugs. Mm-hmm. All this free money enabled him to be an even worse addict.
Right.
Than he already was, she said. Why should taxpayers pay for that?
Well, they shouldn't. 9 out of 10 Americans say that if you give an able-bodied adult cash, food, housing, or medical care from the government, that individual should be required to work or prepare for, at least prepare for work as a condition of getting that aid. People want to be compassionate to people that are in need, but they don't want one-way handouts. They don't. They believe that there should be reciprocal obligation. You assist people, but you expect something positive back in return. The whole thrust here is to go back and reverse welfare reform. Welfare reform under Bill Clinton said, we're not going to give out free cash anymore. We're going to continue to give assistance, but we're going to expect you to take some steps to support yourself. That has been very effective as a long-term strategy for reducing poverty and improving upward mobility. Rather than just saying, well, what we need is another couple trillion dollars and we'll just dump it on people. In fact, when you do that, if you pay people when they're not working, they're going to work less. You're going to have families fall apart because there's no economic need for them to remain together, and everything is going to get worse. You can actually see in almost all of these large urban areas, everything has gotten worse in terms of crime and social chaos while we poured all this money in. I don't think the money caused that, but it certainly isn't helping things. Most of the people that they're saying are poor when they dump in all this money were not poor to begin with. They had, again, total economic resources of over $80,000 a year before all this extra aid came in. There is, however, across the very bottom of our society, communities in Compton, in South Baltimore, in Detroit, in Chicago, that are in extreme social distress, and they have crime, they have family collapse, they have grotesque educational failure, and throwing more welfare money into those communities, particularly in the way that they're doing it, is actually going to make things worse. It's going to make them work less. All of these programs tend to have marriage penalties, which undermines marriage in the community. It's exactly the way you don't want to assist people. What do you need to do if you actually want
to? What do we need to do? What's the right answer?
Okay, the right answer is we continue the basic principle of welfare reform that was formed under Bill Clinton, which says we assist those who need assistance, but we're going to expect you to do something to support yourself. So work and benefits sort of become partners rather than antagonists. When you do that, you can very easily assure that almost everyone has an income well above poverty once you combine pro-work benefits with earnings. If you can't get a job in the short term, we'll give you even more benefits, but we're going to expect you to come down to the welfare office and at least train or prepare for a job. That's a very effective strategy. It keeps people in society, helps them move up rather than out of the ladder of success. We also have to remove all the marriage penalties for low-income couples. When they do get married, the welfare state actually takes away $10,000 or $12,000 in benefits upon the act of marriage. It's a crazy thing. We should stop doing that.
Okay, let me ask you this, because, again, we have only a few moments left to us. We're talking about the homeless issue, which impacts every single American in every American city. Mm-hmm. Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, is kicking in another $12 billion for the Housing First homeless reform, which suggests that the key element in getting people off the street is building more low-income housing. Do you agree with that approach?
No, you're just going to bring in homeless people from all across the country. The problem there with most of these homeless people is mental illness and drug addiction. And if you want to deal with that, you have to have a more controlled environment, and you have to try to deal with those underlying problems. The Housing First says basically we don't care about those problems. And you're basically going to spend a ton of money, and the situation is going to actually probably get worse. What we do need to do is with programs, all the programs that are intended by the government to alter behavior, when you do controlled experiments on them, they don't work. Drug treatment programs don't work. Job training programs don't work. Prison anti-recidivation programs do not work. It's a terrible thing to do to the poor, to run programs with billions of dollars that are known scientifically not to have any effect. How do you fix that? Well, you take all of those programs that are intended to do that, and you turn them so that the provider of the service doesn't get paid unless they have an outcome. You pay not for service, but you pay for outcome. In drug treatment, you pay the provider when drug usage goes down. In anti-recidivism programs, you pay when for those people that are in the program that don't go back to jail. You pay for success. You don't pay just because their service is provided. That would, in fact, improve things tremendously, because all of a sudden there's a huge incentive in this industry that they only get money if they do what they're – if they accomplish the goals of the program. That would be very effective. And that would be helped. The other thing I would do in any inner city area is have school choice. There in Los Angeles, you have some of the worst schools on the North American continent. And basically, those parents should be freed to take a voucher and take those children to some place where they can actually learn something in a safe environment. And the more constructive of those parents would definitely leap on that opportunity if we gave it to them. But the special interests that control the public schools and make money out of the public schools don't want parents to have those choices. Upper middle class families have those choices. Rich people like your governor there, they have all the choices in education they want, but poor families have no choice. They're kept in utterly terrible schools. What an awful thing to do to young people.
That's Robert Rector. He is a senior research fellow in domestic policy for the Heritage Foundation. And you can find out more about his work, read a list of his complete publications. They're very extensive on this issue. And maybe, just maybe, we can move together toward a more positive approach to enduring problems of poverty and homelessness. There's actually a liberal who says that the lack of doing anything meaningful about the homeless crisis has actually caused faith to collapse in California. And clearly that's going to have an impact on the recall election, which is coming up September 14th. We also are going to be speaking coming up to somebody from the political left, and I don't mean the center left, the left left. And Katrina VandenHeuvel is a very well-known columnist and activist, and she wrote a column that I think is going to stimulate and maybe even encourage conservatives. Why? She says that Democrats are losing the narrative on crime and the police. And that could be their doom. Really? So how do Democrats get control of the crime narrative without getting control of the actual crime? We will talk about that and much more. Plus, big new movies coming up like Jungle Cruise, which we'll cover later today. All in this greatest nation on God's green earth.